Can we proceed, please, with case number one? The United States versus ML, ML Moore and others.
May it please the court, my name is Linda Amder, and I'm here on behalf of defendant appellant James Young. Defendant Young was convicted of a single count of attempted extortion that occurred on March 28, 1996, in a related 1924 C firearm violation. Any other allegations brought by the government were rejected by the jury. Defendant Young submits that any action she took on March 28, 1996 did not affect interstate commerce or have a reasonable probability of affecting interstate commerce, and thus she did not commit a crime for which federal prosecution is available. Young was convicted of extorting from an undercover officer known as Silky around $4,790. He was charged jointly with co-defendant M.L. Moore. At trial, the government argued, number one, if defendant understood the proceeds of the extortion to be cocaine proceeds, then interstate commerce element was satisfied. The government also argued that because the Chicago Police Department engaged in interstate commerce by purchasing vehicles and other supplies from out of state, that the Hobbs Act jurisdiction was satisfied.
Could I ask you, the government argues in its brief at this point, that it doesn't really matter what Mr. Young knew as a subjective matter as long as the interstate commerce element is objectively shown on the facts of this case. That strikes me as quite consistent with what we've said about other elements of cases, whether it's an interstate commerce element or whether it's an element about whether somebody's a minor and so forth. And so it has struck me that your principal claim has been that Mr. Young, at the moment he took the money, may not have been aware of these various links. But why does that matter?
I believe that matters because this is an attempted extortion. This is a crime where there must be specific intent. In this particular instance,
but specific intent to do what, I suppose, is what I'm asking. Certainly specific intent to extort, but I wasn't aware of cases that that held the specific intent element went to the jurisdictional interstate commerce element of the Hobbs Act.
Mr. Young does not have to have specific intent to commit a crime that will affect interstate commerce. But it's my understanding that Mr. Young would have to have the specific intent to commit a crime that would, even if unknowing to him, affect interstate commerce.
That's absolutely right. You're right on the money. The problem is, of course, interstate commerce is very easy to prove.
Okay. What I want to move on to is, I want to address first the argument that the government made and basically rested upon in post-trial filings, and I also would say in the government's brief. And that particular argument is that Silky ran an interstate multi-kilogram narcotics organization. Now, looking at that particular argument the government has made, it's our position that by the date of March 28, 1996, and that is the only date on which James Young is convicted for committing any crimes out of this indictment, that at that particular point in time, the government had not established that Silky ran an interstate narcotics business. Evidence of Silky's interstate narcotics business was developed as a ruse or as a pretend narcotics organization later in the FBI's development of its scenario.
Can you tell me, did you raise the issue before the trial court
of the
crimes being committed in violation of interstate commerce?
Yes. In our post-trial motion, we indeed indicated that, excuse me.
Matter before the district court?
Yes, we did raise in the post-trial motion the fact that there had been no depletion of assets from a business that was involved in interstate commerce. And we also raised the issue that, in particular, the involvement that was spoken about here regarding Silky was not something that reflected upon interstate commerce. That's what we raised. There were other things that were said regarding impossibility that we would no longer argue here and we don't believe are applicable. But we did cite the case of Matson, and we did cite the district court case of United States versus Kay.
We need a rebuttal time, you know.
Yeah. I just want to quickly move on.
How much time has she got left? You have 2 minutes left altogether, including rebuttal.
Okay.
Do whatever you want to.
I just want to say that the evidence here does not show factually that my client, James Young, knew that Silky, at that point in time, was a narcotics dealer or there were narcotics transactions taking place in the parking lot where the offense occurred. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Sheldon Nagelberg. I represent appellant Alex Ramos. I wanted to devote the short period of time that I have to two individual issues raised by Mr. Ramos. One is the Section 924C charges. In all circuit authority and in all the litigation that has occurred across the country and in district courts regarding the 924C charges, especially those involving police officers, not one has come close to the facts that were involved with Mr. Ramos. And the reason for that was the uniqueness of the role that Mr. Ramos was designated by Silky. His role was to use his mouth and to use his badge or star to convince a stopping or police officer to allow him to continue through in the escort drive should that occur. Of course, that never did occur. In fact, as the brief shows and is demonstrated in the trial transcript, in a colloquy between Silky and Mr. Ramos, Ramos is concerned, what if showing my badge and speaking is not enough? What do I do? Indicating, implying clearly, Ramos was concerned about getting into the possibility of violence. And Silky, who's the undercover sergeant, says, just walk away. I don't want to have anything. So it was clearly understood the gun was to have no role.
But Mr. Nagelberg, doesn't that mean that perhaps the gun wasn't going to be used, but the other part of the statute is carry, and they were, in fact, engaging Mr. Ramos in his capacity as a police officer. He is carrying the gun, and we have to decide whether that carrying was, quote-unquote, in relation to the offense. So it was surely part of, you know, his role as police officer is what they were getting, and he was carrying a gun.
Well, Your Honor, to answer that, for the sake of argument, I would concede that Mr. Ramos was carrying the gun, but the carrying in and of itself does not buy the in relation. They are two separate elements that need to be shown, and I think clearly from the role, the things I've said, I don't have much time, the gun was to have no relation to the commission of the crime. And that is the essence of what I feel is the error.
Well, what makes the officer threat to anybody to stop is the fact that he has got a gun and he can use it.
Well, no, sir, because his role was not to threaten. His role was what the brotherhood of law enforcement has. And that is, if someone comes up and he wants a favor from a brother officer,
right,
he doesn't display his weapon, of course.
On the other hand, if he doesn't have the weapon, the officer might wonder whether what he's doing.
Well,
he has to be in full uniform, which includes it by the rules of the police department, carrying his gun.
Well, he doesn't have to be in full uniform, Your Honor, and
well, to make it obvious he was a cop, he does.
Well,
was he in full uniform, by the way?
What, sir?
Was he in full uniform?
No, sir.
He just had a star in his gun.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. But he was carrying a gun,
and it was available to him if he needed it in case there was any altercation.
Yes, but this coffee he did not want. He never wanted to get into a situation. It was not to embolden him.
I didn't. That's not what I said, right?
Yes, sir.
Right.
Is my time up?
No.
Hello. Briefly, I just want to move on to the second issue that I feel is salient, and that is the disparity in sentencing. I just would like to point out in terms of the standard of review that the sentencing judge really denied the motion, never made findings of fact, never determined whether or not he had authority to depart under the McMutuary standard. And it is up to this court here to make a de novo analysis of the actions of the sentencing judge. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Stanley Hill. I represent ML Moore. I'd like to concentrate on two points. The first point is the introduction of the proffer against Mr. Moore after the government had offered to use only a portion of that proffer. They made what was in the form of a motion in limine prior to trial, representing to the trial judge that if Moore pursued his public authority defense, a defense which had been laid out in a post-arrest statement made on December 20th, 1996, without the assistance of counsel, early on in the ball game, the government knew what Mr. Moore was talking about, that he was trying to make his big case. He was going after Silky, who he considered to be a big fish. He was trying to net him. He was trying to gain his confidence. Now, the government never had to represent that it would only use a portion of profit. They didn't have to make that representation. They could have said, look, if you come this way, we are going to use the entire proffer. But instead, what they did when they represented to the court, they said, we're going to only use a portion of it. We're going to use a portion of it. Accepted that offer. There was merit consideration. He pursued that defense. And then after the game starts, they come and change the rules. That's not fair. Maybe the jury would have discounted or not believed Mr. Moore. But I think that there's something fundamentally fair when you start off saying, this is all we're going to use, and after you get into the ball game, you say, Judge, you know, we should be allowed to change the rules. They never had to get into that agreement in the first instance.
But isn't your problem that the district court judge, at least, didn't interpret that initial statement by the government as a stipulation or as a contract or anything? She was persuaded by the government's argument that it was a more work in progress, if you will. It was a tentative thing, and it was subject to modification once the trial went on. And isn't that really her call?
But what she said in her opinion, respectfully, was that this is the government's proposal regarding what it would do. Well, I view a proposal as an offer. You know, I accept your proposal at your word. There was valid consideration. Now, they can back off and say that's not what it was, but I was a trial lawyer, and if I had known that they were going to bring all of that stuff in against Mr. Moore, I would have said, maybe you shouldn't be pursuing this public authority, but if this is all they're going to use, they've indicated that to the court, that's your defense, you've been saying it since day one, let's go for it. And it's not fair, once the game begins, regardless of what you think of Moore, or this case, or his defense, it's just not fair to change the rules of the game once the ball game begins. Second point, Ramos' statement. If Ramos had taken the stand, and there's a rule that says you can use a statement where clearly it's against penal interest, but in this instance, that statement by Ramos was an attempt by him to shift the blame to Moore for purposes of making his role seem a little lesser. Well, you have a situation where the evidentiary rule impedes upon the confrontation clause of the Sixth Amendment. The rule is trumped by the Constitution. It's trumped by the confrontation clause. And you can't use that statement. They introduce a statement against Moore where Ramos is saying, he did this, he did this, I didn't do this, he did this, I didn't do that. And I don't even have an opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Ramos on it. That's not fair, and they didn't need the statement. What did they need it for?
Well, why doesn't that make all this harmless error, then, even if you're right?
Well, I don't think it's harmless error, Because what you're talking about is Moore being, what they used all of those other crimes for was to bury Mr. Moore. Now, I'm not saying they wouldn't have been able to do it initially, but once they represented that they wouldn't, I think they were precluded from changing the rule in the middle of the game. We have to be able to rely upon the fairness of the process, regardless of what we think about the facts of the case. Thank you very much for your
time.
Thank
you, counsel. All right.
Mm-hmm. Well,
is there anybody else for the item? All right. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is John Brennan. I work for the Department of Justice, and I represent the United States in this proceeding. Let me just run through these points here, Your Honor. With respect to circuits are quite consistent that in the Hobbs Act, the person violating the Hobbs Act does not need to have a specific intent to violate the Hobbs Act. In this case, these are intent crimes and were charged as such. However, there is no case that we've been able to determine that requires that there be knowledge on the part of the offender that the jurisdictional element of the Hobbs Act is satisfied. In any event, it wouldn't make any difference.
But that's already been conceded by your opponents, so why bad it again?
Well, let me point out this. It's simply a tempest in a teapot in that Young, in that first robbery, found in Silky's car cocaine wrappers in kilogram sizes, scales, plastic bags. Those clearly indicated that this was a drug dealer. So there's simply no way that he didn't, in fact, satisfy the intent requirement, although, as I said, I don't think there is an intent requirement here.
Well, don't you agree, Mr. Drennan, that in light of Supreme Court cases like Jones, the court is sending a message that it really doesn't want every state robbery or every state crime federalized just because there's some way of linking it up to interstate commerce? That's precisely what they said they didn't want to do in Jones. Why isn't this going to be the next area they look at and say, gee, this is a robbery of $4,000, not a very nice thing to do to somebody, but on the other hand, is it a federal crime as opposed to a state crime?
In this case, well, to answer your question, I do believe that the Supreme Court may be interested in this area and is sending some message through Jones. I would point out that they've denied cert in a number of cases, including recently Jameson out of the Second Circuit. However, here we're not going to have a problem. Here it's clear that this was a robbery of a business.
A
robbery of a business. It was an illegal business, a cocaine business, but this is not like the Sixth Circuit case in Wang where there was a home invasion and there was robberies of individuals and $1,200 had been taken out of a restaurant's cash register, $900 of which was going to be deposited into a restaurant's bank account the next day. In other words, sort of de minimis effect, an attenuated connection that was, it was happenstance that person happened to take the money out of the cash register and then was robbed. This is not that case. This is an actual case of interrupting transactions as they were going on, robbing stash houses, taking the inventories and the buying money of a business. So we don't have that problem with this case. However, the Supreme Court's going with respect to Jones.
In terms of the business, I wonder if I could flip over to the judicial notice of the fact that cocaine all comes from South America. I mean, surely there are hothouses if you felt like spending the money that you could grow coca plants in Chicago or anywhere else. How can that be the kind of thing that's a proper subject of judicial notice?
Well, I would point out that there is no evidence that there are hothouses. The only case that accounts were able to cite was Malagos in the Second Circuit, and clearly there it was an importation of cocaine paste and
a
finishing off process in New York. So, of course, this sort of thing can change. You're right. Maybe we'll find that in California they can grow cocaine, but right now all cocaine comes from South America. I think that's amply demonstrated from the websites I've given you and books on cocaine. another point would be this court has, seems to have taken judicial notice of the fact that all cocaine at the moment comes from South America.
I'm just entertaining hypothetical thought that we might not be right now and then, but and you had a stipulation for two of the defendants, so this, I don't think there's even an issue for them.
Well, with respect to the stipulation, we would claim that the stipulation is not the operative fact here. Rather, it's the evidence that that cocaine came from South America. Nobody objected to that evidence. They allowed that to become part of the jury instruction. So we're not claiming that the stipulation binds all defendants. We're just claiming that there was evidence that cocaine comes from South America. It was presented. They could have cross-examined. They could have brought the witness.
Could you remind me what that evidence was? Because that I'm not...
The evidence was a stipulation. Well, it was stipulated testimony, but it was testimony read into the record by a government witness from a DEA, I think it was a DEA, drug expert, saying that heroin and cocaine, or at least the precursors, come from outside the United States. Nobody objected to that. So we don't really need to rely on the judicial notice aspect of it. I'd also point out it's entirely unclear that the district court had jurisdiction to make that ruling. This issue came up 2 years after the motions for judgment and acquittal were finalized. Again, these are jurisdictional deadlines, so there's really not much jurisdictional traction here for that ruling. I'm going to move on to the 924 charges with respect to Ramos. Your Honor is correct. The issue here is carried, not used. It's entirely clear that Ramos and Moore carried their weapons. In fact, all of these defendants carried their weapons during their thefts and escorts. The next question would be in relation to. This court and every other court has interpreted the in relation to prong of 924 to be very, very broad. Here, clearly, they were, with respect to Ramos here, what was being bought was a role as police officer, or as a role to be a police officer, it's required that you wear a gun, you can't have to wear a weapon, even if you're not in uniform. Therefore, they were buying a gun.
So would you say that all police officers who commit crimes have automatically also violated 924C?
No, there are other prongs here.
So, but they're going to carry a weapon, well, I'll say crimes of violence or drug crimes. All police officers who are involved in anything having to do with a crime of violence or a drug crime have also automatically violated 924C.
If they've carried their weapon and that weapon has emboldened them, or they have in any way used that weapon, yes. Of course,
even
it does have to be a drug crime because...
Right, no, I realize it's part of the statute.
Did I cut your arm off?
No, please, continue.
With respect to the sentencing disparity, I think it's fairly clear, again, in this and every other circuit, that there does not need to be an explicit finding by the district court that the district court had authority to consider a downward departure. If there's an experienced judge, and Judge Williams certainly was an experienced judge, we can presume that the judge knows the law. We can presume the judge knows the limits of her authority. In this case, she elected not to have a downward departure because of the disparities between Lennon Shields and Ramos. Therefore, there is no jurisdiction in this case to consider a downward departure. I think that issue can be disposed of immediately. I'll move on to the proffer, Moore's proffer. I think the basic point here is a factual point. The claim, as I understand it, is that the government reneged on a deal. That requires there to be a deal. The district court considered that question and found that there was no promise, there was no deal. So these issues about valid consideration, contract, offer, they just don't come up. The government presented a proffer that said, look, here's what we think is going to work for us. At that point, all they knew was that Moore was going to pursue a public authority defense. When it became clear that he was actually putting his intent at issue and saying, look, there was absolutely nothing that I did wrong here. In fact, I was following the law. There was no intent to do wrong. That's when the entire proffer came in.
So what's the difference, though? I mean, isn't that the essence of the public authority defense that everything I did, I was doing under the authority of the law, and I suppose the converse of that is, therefore, I didn't intend to be violating any other rules.
Well, the difference is the everything. If when one reads the proffer, it's entirely clear that it is not the case that everything he did was according to the law. That changed when we got to trial, and then he was claiming that it was. But for instance, he took the money and he spent it on alcohol and prostitutes, and that's not consistent with the law. So bring that in, obviously valid. I would also point out, we're really not talking about very much, the big ticket item, the difference between the redacted proffer and the proffer that came in was the shakedown of Schmonte Taylor, I believe in 1995, for $1,200. So it's really a very small difference here. Even that said, I should point out that this would be clearly harmless error. Moore, there was overwhelming evidence against Moore, videotape, audio tape, testimony. There's no way he wouldn't have been convicted with or without the with the redacted proffer or with the full proffer. Let me move on to the Ramos statement. As I understand it, the argument here settles on the Sixth Amendment. The presumption that the Sixth Amendment is in play here, I think, is an error. For the Sixth Amendment to come into play, we would need a statement that shifts blame or in some way lessens blame. Here, it's entirely clear that Ramos walked in and he confessed. There's nothing that helped him here. There's nothing that could have possibly ameliorated his situation. He was simply, caught. They presented him with the evidence. He came in. He said what he did. He explained how it came to be.
Now, didn't he basically say, Moore's the one who got me into it, Moore's the one who suggested, but your point would be, I suppose, that as soon as he said, but I was in it, he's already sufficiently against penal interest that it's not the shifting scenario.
Well, it's not a shifting because he confessed to conspiracy, and to confess to conspiracy necessarily means to implicate someone. The Sixth Amendment does not insulate people from confessing to conspiracies, which apparently is appellant's theory. I see that I'm running low on time.
I'm
arguing.
Okay. When that light turns red, you're through.
Okay, right. Let me finish up on that point then. In any event, this is entirely clear that it was harmless error. The entire, the incident where Ramos, Officer Shepard and Moore got together and formed this conspiracy was videotaped. It was audiotaped. There was testimony to that effect from Officer Shepard. With respect to the actual police escorts, they were videotaped, they were audiotaped, and there was testimony from several officers. So again, at worst, this would be harmless error. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You got 1 minute. All right.
On behalf of James Young, I simply want to point out to this court that when James Young went to the parking lot on March the 28th of 1996, he did not know anything about Silky. He did not know anything about cocaine proceeds, cocaine transactions. It was not proven in the government's case by the testimony of Silky that there were any cocaine transactions going down, or that any time Silky conveyed to James Young that cocaine was in the parking lot. The scale itself was never recovered, and it was M.L. Moore that recovered the cocaine wrapper. Later, James Young was made aware of the fact that there had been a cocaine wrapper, but there never was anything set in that parking lot to indicate the money involved had to do with cocaine. Secondly, I simply want to again point out to the court that in the during the course of the trial, we made motion for judgment of acquittal after the government rested. We made motion for judgment of acquittal after all of the evidence was in, and then we filed in post-trial motions and specifically raised the argument that the government had to show that there had been a business engaged in interstate commerce and that through the wrongful activity, that there was a depletion of assets. Our case is different from that of the other defendants in that when the events transpired pertaining to James Young, this entire government theory of the big narcotics dealer Silky and his vast organization has simply not been developed by the government to the extent there were telephone calls that were specifically excluded from evidence by Judge
Swift. Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and proceed to case number 2.